This is Audible.
Audio Renaissance presents 10 Big Ones by Janet Ivanovich. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1. The way I see it, life is a jelly donut. You don't really know what it's about until you bite into it. And then, just when you decide it's good, you drop a big glob of jelly on your best t-shirt. My name is Stephanie Plum, and I drop a lot of jelly globs, figuratively and literally. Like the time I accidentally burned down a funeral home, that was the mother of all jelly globs. I got my picture in the paper for that one. I'd walk down the street and people would recognize me. "You're famous now," my mother said when the paper came out. "You have to set an example. You have to exercise, eat good food, and be nice to old people." Okay, so my mother was probably right, but I'm from Jersey, and truth is, I have a hard time getting a grip on the good example thing. A good example in Jersey isn't exactly the national ideal. Not to mention, I inherited a lot of unmanageable brown hair and rude hand gestures from my father's Italian side of the family. What am I supposed to do with that? My mother's side is Hungarian, and from this I get blue eyes and the ability to eat birthday cake and still button the top snap on my jeans. I'm told the good Hungarian metabolism lasts only until I'm 40, so I'm counting down. The Hungarian genes also carry a certain amount of luck and gypsy intuition, both of which I need in my present job. I'm a bond enforcement agent, working for my cousin, Vincent Plum, and I run down bad guys. I'm not the best BEA in the world, and I'm not the worst. An incredibly hot guy with the street name Ranger is the best, and my sometimes partner Lula is possibly the worst. Maybe it's not fair to have Lula in the running for worst bounty hunter of all time. To begin with, there are some really bad bounty hunters out there. And more to the point, Lula isn't actually a bounty hunter. Lula is a former hooker who was hired to do the filing for the bail bonds office, but spends a lot of her day trailing after me. At the moment, Lula and I were standing in the parking lot of a deli mart on Hamilton Avenue. We were about a half mile from the office, and we were leaning against my yellow Ford Escape, trying to make a lunch choice. We were debating nachos at the deli mart against a sub at Giovicini's. "Hey," I said to Lula. "What happened to the filing job? Who does the filing now?"
"I do the filing. I filed an ass out of that office."
"You're never in the office."
"The hell I am. I was in the office when you showed up this morning."
"Yeah, but you weren't filing. You were doing your nails."
"I was thinking about filing. And if you hadn't needed my help going to look for that loser Roger Banker, I'd still be filing."
Roger was accused of grand theft auto and possession of controlled substances. In layman's terms, Roger got high and went joyriding. "So you're still officially a file clerk?"
"Heck no," Lula said. "That's so boring. Do I look like a file clerk to you?"
Actually, Lula still looked like a hooker. Lula's a full-bodied black woman who favors animal print spandex enhanced with sequins. I figure Lula didn't want to hear my fashion opinion, so I didn't say anything. I just raised an eyebrow.
"The job title is tricky since I do a lot of this here bounty hunter stuff, but I've never really been given any of my own cases," Lula said. "I suppose I could be your bodyguard."
"Oh, my God." Lula narrowed her eyes at me.
"You got a problem with that?"
"It seems a little Hollywood."
"Yeah, but sometimes you need some extra firepower, right? And there I am. Hell, you don't even carry a gun half the time. I always got a gun. I got a gun now, just in case."
And Lula pulled a .40 caliber Glock out of her purse.
"I don't mind using it either. I'm good with a gun. I got an eye for it. Watch me hit that bottle next to the bike."
Someone had leaned a fancy red mountain bike against the big plate glass window in front of the deli mart. There was a quart bottle next to the bike. The bottle had a rag stuffed into it.
"No," I said. "No shooting."
Too late. Lula squeezed off a shot, missed the bottle, and destroyed the bike's rear tire.
"Oops,"
Lula said, doing a grimace and immediately returning the gun to her purse. A moment later, a guy ran out of the store. He was wearing a mechanic's jumpsuit and a red devil mask. He had a small backpack slung over one shoulder, and he had a gun in his right hand. His skin tone was darker than mine, but lighter than Lula's. He grabbed the bottle off the ground, lit the rag with a flick of his bic, and threw the bottle into the store. He turned to get onto the bike and realized his tire was blown to smithereens.
"Fuck," the guy said. "Fuck!" "I didn't do it," Lula said. "Wasn't me. Someone came along and shot up your tire. You must not be popular."
There was a lot of shouting inside the store. The guy in the devil mask turned to flee, and Victor, the Pakistani day manager, rushed out the door.
"I am done. Do you hear me?" Victor yelled. "This is the fourth robbery this month, and I won't stand for any more. You are dog excrement," he shouted at the guy in the mask. "Dog excrement!"
Lula had her hand back in her purse.
"Hold on, I got a gun," she said. "Where the hell is it? Why can't you ever find the damn gun when you need it?"
Victor threw the still lit but clearly unbroken bottle at the guy in the devil mask, hitting him in the back of the head. The bottle bounced off the devil's head and smashed against my driver's side door. The devil staggered and instinctively pulled the mask off. Maybe he couldn't breathe, or maybe he went to feel for blood, or maybe he just wasn't thinking. Whatever the reason, the mask was only off for a second before being yanked back over the guy's head. He turned and looked directly at me, and then he ran across the street and disappeared into the alley between two buildings. The bottle instantly ignited when it hit my car, and flames raced along the side and the undercarriage of the Escape.
"Holy crap," Lula said, looking up from her purse. "Damn."
"Why me?" I shrieked. "Why does this always happen to me? I can't believe this car is on fire. My cars are always getting exploded. How many cars have I lost like this since you've known me?"
"A lot," Lula said.
"It's embarrassing. What am I going to tell my insurance company?"
"It wasn't your fault," Lula said.
"It's never my fault. Do they care? I don't think they care."
"You got bad car karma," Lula said. "But at least you're lucky in love."
For the last couple months, I've been living with Joe Morelli. Morelli's a very sexy, very handsome Trenton cop. Morelli and I have a long history and possibly a long future. Mostly we take it day by day, neither of us feeling the need for a documented commitment right now. The good thing about living with a cop is that you never have to call home when disaster strikes. As you might suspect, that's also the bad part. Seconds after the emergency call goes in on the robbery and car fire describing my yellow Escape, at least 40 different cops, EMTs, and firefighters will track Morelli down and tell him his girlfriend's done it again. Lula and I moved farther from the fire, knowing from experience that an explosion was a possibility. We stood patiently waiting, listening to the sirens whining in the distance, getting closer by the second. Morelli's unmarked cop car would be minutes behind the sirens. And somewhere in the mix of emergency vehicles, my professional mentor and man of mystery, Ranger, would slide in to check things out.
"Maybe I should leave," Lula said. "There's all that filing back at the office, and cops give me the runs."
Not to mention she was illegally carrying a concealed weapon that was instrumental in this whole fiasco. "Did you see the guy's face when he pulled his mask off?" I asked her.
"No, I was looking for my gun. I missed that."
"Then leaving might be a good idea," I said. "Get me a sub on the way back to the office. I don't think they'll be making nachos here for a while."
"I'd rather have the sub anyways. A car fire always gives me an appetite."
And Lula took off, power walking. Victor was on the other side of the car, stomping around and pulling at his hair. He stopped stomping and fixed his attention on me.
"Why didn't you shoot him? I know you. You are a bounty hunter. You should have shot him."
"I'm not carrying a gun," I told Victor.
"Not carrying a gun? What kind of bounty hunter are you? I watch television. I know about these things. Bounty hunters always have many guns."
"Actually, shooting people is a no-no in bond enforcement." Victor shook his head.
"I don't know what this world is coming to when bounty hunters don't shoot people."
A blue and white patrol car arrived, and two uniforms got out and stood, hands on hips, taking it all in. I knew both cops, Andy Zajac and Robin Russell. Andy Zajac was riding shotgun. 2 months ago, he'd been plainclothes, but he'd asked a local politician some embarrassing questions during a robbery investigation and had gotten busted back to uniform. It could have been worse. Zajac could have been assigned to a desk in the Tower of Irrelevance. Sometimes things could get tricky in the Trenton Police Department. Zajac waved when he saw me. He said something to Russell, and they both smiled, no doubt enjoying the continuing calamitous exploits of Stephanie Plum. I'd gone to school with Robin Russell. She was a year behind me, so we weren't the closest of friends, but I liked her. She wasn't especially athletic when she was in high school. She was one of the quiet, brainy kids, and she surprised everyone when she joined Trenton PD 2 years ago. A fire truck followed Zajac and Russell, plus two more cop cars and an EMT truck. By the time Morelli arrived, the hoses and chemical extinguishers were already out and in use. Morelli angled his car behind Robin Russell's and walked across to me. Morelli was lean and hard-muscled with wary cop eyes that softened in the bedroom. His hair was almost black, falling in waves over his forehead, brushing his collar. He was wearing a slightly oversized blue shirt with the sleeves rolled, black jeans, and black boots with a Vibram sole. He had his gun on his hip, and with or without the gun, he didn't look like someone you'd want to mess with. There was a tilt to his mouth that could pass for a smile. Then again, it could just as easily be a grimace.
"Are you okay?"
"It wasn't my fault," I told him. This got a genuine smile from him.
"Cupcake, it's never your fault."
His eyes traveled to the red mountain bike with the destroyed tire.
"What's with the bike?"
"Lula accidentally shot the tire. Then a guy wearing a red devil mask ran out of the store, took a look at the bike, tossed a Molotov cocktail into the store, and set off on foot. The bottle didn't break, so Victor pitched it at the devil. The bottle bounced off the devil's head and crashed against my car."
"I didn't hear the part about Lula shooting the tire."
"Yeah, I figured it wasn't necessary to mention that in the official statement." I looked past Morelli as a black Porsche 911 Turbo pulled to the curb. There weren't a lot of people in Trenton who could afford the car, mostly high-level drug dealers, and Ranger. I watched as Ranger angled out from behind the wheel and ambled over. He was about the same height as Morelli, but he had more bulk to his muscle. Morelli was a cat. Ranger was Rambo meets Batman. Ranger was in SWAT black cargo pants and t-shirt. His hair was dark, and his eyes were dark, and his skin reflected his Cuban ancestry. No one knew Ranger's age, but I'd guess it was close to mine, late 20s to early 30s. No one knew where Ranger lived or where his cars and cash originated. Probably it was best not to know. Ranger nodded to Morelli and locked eyes with me. Sometimes it felt like Ranger could look you in the eye and know all the stuff that was inside your head. It was a little unnerving, but it saved a lot of time since talk wasn't necessary.
"Babe,"
Ranger said, and he left. Morelli watched Ranger get into his Porsche and take off.
"Half the time I'm happy to have him watching over you, and half the time it scares the hell out of me. He's always in black, the address on his driver's license is a vacant lot, and he never says anything."
"Maybe he has a dark history, like Batman, a tortured soul."
"Tortured soul? Ranger? Cupcake, the guy's a mercenary."
Morelli playfully twirled a strand of my hair around his finger.
"You've been watching Dr. Phil again, right? Oprah? Geraldo? Crossing over with John Edward?"
"Crossing over with John Edward. And Ranger's not a mercenary, at least not officially in Trenton. He's a bounty hunter, like me."
"Yeah, and I really hate that you're a bounty hunter."
"Okay, I know I have a crappy job. The money isn't all that great, and sometimes people shoot at me. Still, someone's got to make sure the accused show up in court." "I do a service for the community," I told Morelli. "If it wasn't for people like me, the police would have to track these guys. The taxpayer would have to foot the bill for a larger police force."
"I'm not disputing the job. I just don't want you doing it."
There was a loud phoomph sound from the underside of my car. Flames shot out, and a steaming tire popped off and rolled across the lot.
"This is the 14th Red Devil robbery," Morelli said. "The routine is always the same. Rob the store at gunpoint, get away on a bike. Cover your getaway with a bottle bomb.
No one's ever seen enough to ID him.
Until now, I said. I saw the guy's face. I didn't recognize him, but I think I could pick him out of a lineup. An hour later, Morelli dropped me off at the bond office. He snagged me by the back of my shirt as I was leaving his unmarked, seen better days Crown Vic cop car.
You're gonna be careful, right?
Right.
And you're not gonna let Lula do any more shooting.
I did a mental sigh. He was asking the impossible. Sometimes it's hard to control Lula.
Then get a different partner.
Ranger?
Very funny, Morelli said.
He French kissed me goodbye, and I thought probably I could control Lula. When Morelli kissed me, I thought anything was possible. Morelli was a terrific kisser. His pager buzzed, and he pulled away to check the readout.
I have to go, he said, shoving me out the door.
I leaned in the window at him. Remember, we promised my mom we'd come for dinner tonight.
No way. You promised. I didn't promise. I had dinner at your parents' house 3 days ago, and once a week is my limit. Valerie and the kids will be there, right? And Clown? I'm getting heartburn just thinking about it. Anybody who eats with that crew should get combat pay.
He was right. I had no comeback. A little over a year ago, my sister's husband took off for parts unknown with the babysitter. Valerie immediately moved back home with her two kids and took a job with a struggling lawyer, Albert Clown. Somehow, Clown managed to get Val pregnant, and in 9 months' time, my parents' small three-bedroom, one-bathroom house in the Chambersburg section of Trenton was home to my mom, my dad, Grandma Mazur, Valerie, Albert Clown, Val's two little girls, and newborn baby. As a short-term fix to my sister's housing dilemma, I volunteered the use of my apartment. I was spending most of my nights with Morelli anyway, so it wasn't a total sacrifice on my part. It's now 3 months down the road, and Valerie is still in my apartment, returning to my parents' house every night for dinner. Once in a while, something fun happens at dinner, like Grandma setting the tablecloth on fire or Clown choking on a chicken bone. But usually, it's just flat-out migraine-inducing bedlam. Boy, too bad you'll miss the roast chicken with gravy and mashed potatoes, I told Morelli in a last-ditch effort. Probably pineapple upside-down cake for dessert.
Not gonna work. You're gonna have to come up with something better than roast chicken to get me over to your parents' house tonight.
What, like wild gorilla sex?
Not even wild gorilla sex. It would have to be an orgy with identical Japanese triplets.
I gave Morelli an eye roll, and I left for the bond office.
Your sub's filed under S, Lula said when I swung through the door. I got you capicola and provolone and turkey and pepperoni with some hot peppers.
I opened the file and retrieved my sub. There's only half a sandwich here.
Well, yeah, Lula said. Me and Connie decided you wouldn't want to get fat by eating that whole sub all yourself, so we helped you out.
Vincent Plum Bail Bonds is a small storefront office on Hamilton Avenue. Ordinarily, a more lucrative location for a bonds office would be across from the courts or the lockup. Vinny's office is across from the Berg, and a lot of Vinny's repeat customers are local. Not that the Berg is a bad neighborhood. Truth is, the Berg is possibly the safest place to live if you have to live in Trenton. There's a lot of low-level mob in the Berg, and if you misbehave in the Berg, you could quietly disappear for a very long time. Like forever. It's even possible that some of Connie's relatives might assist in the disappearance. Connie is Vinny's office manager. She's 5'4" and looks like Betty Boop, with a mustache. Her desk is positioned in front of Vinny's small inner office, preventing the unsuspecting from walking in on Vinny while he's on the phone with his bookie, taking a snooze, or having a private conversation with his Johnson. Also, behind Connie's desk is a bank of file cabinets. And behind the file cabinets is a small stockroom packed with guns and ammo, office supplies, bathroom supplies, and assorted confiscated booty that mostly runs to computers, fake Rolex watches, and fake Louis Vuitton handbags. I slouched onto the scarred, dung-brown fake leather couch that was positioned against a side wall of the outer office and unwrapped the sub.
Big day in court yesterday, Connie said, waving a handful of manila folders at me. We had three guys fail to appear. The bad news is they're all chump change. The good news is none of them have killed or raped in the last 2 years.
I took the folders from Connie and returned to the couch.
I suppose you want me to find these guys, I said to Connie.
Yeah, Connie said. Finding them would be good. Dragging their asses back to jail would be even better.
I flipped through the folders. Harold Pancheck, wanted for indecent exposure and destruction of personal property. What's the deal on Harold? I asked Connie.
He's local. Moved to the burg 3 years ago from Newark. Lives in one of the row houses on Canner Street. Got drunk 2 weeks ago and tried to take a leak on Mrs. Gooding's cat, Ben. Ben was a moving target, and Pancheck mostly got the side of Gooding's house and Gooding's favorite rosebush. Killed the rosebush and took the paint off the house. And Gooding says she washed the cat 3 times, and he still smells like asparagus.
Lula and I had our faces frozen in curled lip grimaces.
He doesn't sound like much of a threat, Connie said. Just make sure you stand back if he whips it out to relieve himself.
I took a quick look at the 2 remaining files. Carol Cantell wanted for holding up a Frito-Lay truck. This brought an instant smile to my face. Carol Cantell was a woman after my own heart. The smile turned to raised eyebrows when I saw the name on the last file. Salvatore Sweet, charged with assault.
Oh, my God, I said to Connie. It's Sally. I haven't seen him in ages.
When I first met Salvatore Sweet, he was playing lead guitar for a transvestite rock band. He helped me solve a crime and then disappeared into the night.
Hey, I remember Sally Sweet, Lula said. He was the shit. What's he doing now besides beating on people?
Driving a school bus, Connie said. Guess the rock career didn't work out. He's living on Fenton Street over by the Button Factory.
Sally Sweet was an MTV car crash. He was a nice guy, but he couldn't get through a sentence without using the F word 14 times. The kids on Sally's bus probably had the most inventive vocabularies in the school. Have you tried calling him? I asked Connie.
Yeah, no answer, and no answering machine.
How about Cantel? I talked to her earlier. She said she'd kill herself before she'd go to jail. She said you were going to have to come over there and shoot her and then drag her dead body out of the house.
It says here she held up a Frito-Lay truck.
Apparently she was on that no-carbohydrate diet, got her period, and snapped when she saw the truck parked in front of a convenience store. Just got whacked out at the thought of all those chips. She threatened the driver with a nail file, filled her car with bags of Fritos, and took off, leaving the driver standing there in front of his empty truck. The police asked him why he didn't stop her, and he said she was a woman on the edge. He said his wife got to looking like that sometimes, and he didn't go near her when she was like that either.
I've been on that diet, and this crime makes perfect sense to me, Lula said, especially if she had her period. You don't want to go through your period without Fritos. Where are you going to get your salt from? And what about cramps? What are you supposed to take for cramps?
My doll, Connie said.
Well, yeah, but you gotta have some Fritos while you're waiting for the Midol to kick in. Fritos have a common influence on a woman.
Vinny stuck his head out the door of his inner office and glared at me.
What are you sitting around for? We got 3 FTAs in this morning, and you already had one in your possession. 4 FTAs. Christ, I'm not running a charity here.
Vinny is my cousin on my father's side of the family and sole owner of Vincent Plum Bail Bonds. He's an oily little guy with slick-back black hair, pointy-toed shoes, and a bunch of gold chains hanging around his scrawny, tanning salon tan neck. It's rumored that he once had a romantic relationship with a duck. He drives a Cadillac Seville, and he's married to Harry the Hammer's only daughter. Vinny's rating as a human being would be in the vicinity of pond slime. His rating as a bonds agent would be considerably higher. Vinny understood human weakness.
I haven't got a car, I told Vinny. My car got firebombed.
What's your point? Your cars are always getting firebombed. Have Lula drive you. She doesn't do anything around here anyway. Your ass, Lula said.
Vinny pulled his head back into his office, and he slammed and locked the door. Connie rolled her eyes, and Lula flipped Vinny the finger.
I saw that, Vinny yelled from behind his closed door. I hate when he's right, Lula said. But there's no reason why we can't use my car. I just don't want to pick up the drunken leaker. If he takes paint off a house, I'm not letting him near my upholstery.
Try Cantel, Connie said. She should still be at home.
15 minutes later, we were in front of Cantel's house in Hamilton Township. It was a trim little ranch on a small lot in a neighborhood of similar houses. The grass was neatly cut, but it was patchy with crabgrass and parched from a hot, dry August.
Young azaleas bordered the front of the house. A blue Honda Civic was parked in the driveway.
"Don't look like the home of a hijacker," Lula said. "No garage."
Sounds like this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We approached the front door and knocked, and Cantel answered.
"Oh, God," Cantel said. "Don't tell me you're from the bond agency. I told the woman on the phone I didn't want to go to jail."
"This is just a rebooking process," I told her. "We bring you in, and then Vinny bonds you out again."
"No way. I'm not going back to that jail. It's too embarrassing. I'd rather you shoot me and kill me."
"We wouldn't shoot you," Lula said, "unless, of course, you drew a gun. What we do is gas you. We got pepper spray, or we could zap you with a stun gun. My choice would be the stun gun on account of we're using my car, and there's a lot of snot produced if we give you a face full of pepper spray. I just have my car detailed. I don't want the back seat full of snot."
Cantel's mouth dropped open, and her eyes glazed over.
"I just took a couple bags of chips," she said. "It's not like I'm a criminal."
Lula looked around.
"You wouldn't have any of them chips left over, would you?"
"I gave them all back, except for the ones I ate."
Cantel had short brown hair and a pleasant round face. She was dressed in jeans and an extra roomy t-shirt. Her age was listed as 32. "You should have kept your court date," I said to Cantel. "You might have only gotten community service."
"I didn't have anything to wear," she wailed. "Look at me. I'm a house. Nothing fits. I ate a truck full of Fritos."
"You're not as big as me," Lula said, "and I got a lot of stuff to wear. You just got to know how to shop. We should go out shopping together someday. My secret is I only buy spandex, and I buy too small. That way it sucks everything in. Not that I'm fat or anything. It's just I got a lot of muscle."
Lula was currently in athletic gear mode, wearing hot pink stretch pants, matching halter top, and serious running shoes. The strain on the spandex was frightening. I was heading for cover at the first sign of a seam unraveling. "Here's the plan," I said to Cantel. "I'm going to call Vinny and have him meet us at the courthouse. That way you can get bonded out immediately, and you won't have to sit around in a holding cell."
"I guess that would be okay," Cantel said. "But you have to get me back here before my kids get off the school bus."
"Sure," I said. "But just in case, maybe you want to make alternative arrangements."
"And maybe I can lose some weight before I have to go to court," Cantel said.
"Be a good idea not to hold up any more snack food trucks," Lula said.
"I had my period. I needed those chips."
"Hey, I hear you," Lula said.
After we got Cantel rebooked and rebonded and returned to her house, Lula drove me across town back to the burg.
"That wasn't so bad," Lula said. "She seemed like a real nice person. Do you think she's going to show up for court this time?"
"No. We're going to have to go over to her house and drag her to court, kicking and screaming."
"Yeah, that's what I think, too."
Lula pulled to the curb and idled in front of my parents' house. Lula drove a red Firebird that had a sound system capable of broadcasting rap over a 5-mile radius. Lula had the sound on low, but the bass at capacity, and I could feel my fillings vibrating. "Thanks for the ride," I told Lula. "See you tomorrow."
"Yo,"
Lula said, and she took off. My Grandma Mazur was at the front door waiting for me. Grandma Mazur rooms with my parents now that Grandpa Mazur is living La Vida Loca everlasting. Grandma Mazur has a body like a soup chicken and a mind that defies description. She keeps her steel-gray hair cut short and tightly permed. She prefers pastel polyester pantsuits and white tennis shoes. And she watches wrestling. Grandma doesn't care if wrestling's fake or real. Grandma likes to look at big men in little spandex panties.
"Hurry up," Grandma said. "Your mother won't start serving drinks until you're at the table, and I need one real bad. I had the day from heck. I traipsed all the way over to Steva's funeral parlor for Lorraine Schnagel's viewing, and she turned out to have a closed casket. I heard she looked real bad at the end, but that's still no reason to deprive people from seeing the deceased. People count on getting a look. I made an effort to get there, dressing up and everything, and now I'm not going to have anything to talk about when I get my hair done tomorrow. I was counting on Lorraine Schnagel."
"You didn't try to open the casket, did you?"
"Me? Of course not. I wouldn't do such a thing. And anyway, it was locked up real tight."
"Is Valerie here?"
"Valerie's always here," Grandma said. That's another reason I'm having the day from heck. I was all tired out after the big disappointment at the funeral parlor, and I couldn't take a nap on account of your niece is back to being a horse and won't stop the galloping, and she whinnies all the time. Between the baby crying and the horse thing, I'm pooped. I bet I got bags under my eyes. If this keeps up, I'm gonna lose my looks.
Grandma squinted up and down the street.
Where's your car?
It sort of caught fire.
Did the tires pop off? Was there an explosion?
Yep.
Darn, I wish I'd seen that. I always miss the good stuff. How'd it catch fire this time?
It happened at a crime scene.
I'm telling you, this town's going to hell in a handbasket. We never had so much crime. It's getting to where you don't want to go out of the neighborhood.
Grandma was right about the crime. I saw it escalating at the bond office. More robberies, more drugs on the street, more murders. Most of it drug and gang related. And now I had seen the Red Devil's face, so I was sucked into it. Chapter 2. I found my mom at the kitchen sink peeling potatoes. My sister Valerie was in the kitchen too. Valerie was seated at the small wood table, and she was nursing the baby. It seemed to me Valerie was always nursing the baby. There were times when I looked at the baby and felt the pull of maternal yearnings, but mostly I was glad I had a hamster. Grandma followed me into the kitchen, anxious to tell everyone the news.
"She blew up her car again," Grandma announced.
My mother stopped peeling.
"Was anyone hurt?"
"No," I said, "just the car. It was totaled." My mother made the sign of the cross and took a white-knuckled grip on the paring knife.
"I hate when you blow up cars," she said. "How am I supposed to sleep at night knowing I have a daughter who blows up cars?"
"You could try drinking," Grandma said. "That always works for me. Nothing like a good healthy snort before bedtime."
My cell phone chirped, and everyone paused while I answered.
"Are you having fun yet?" Morelli wanted to know.
"Yeah, I just got to my parents' house and it's lots of fun. Too bad you're missing it."
"Bad news. You're gonna have to miss it too. One of the guys just brought in a suspect, and you're going to have to ID him."
"Now?"
"Yeah, now. Do you need a ride?"
"No, I'll borrow the Buick."
When my great-uncle Sandor went into a nursing home, he gave his 53 powder blue and white Buick Roadmaster to Grandma Mazur. Since Grandma Mazur doesn't drive, at least not legally, the car mostly sits in my father's garage. It gets 5 miles to a gallon of gas. It drives like a refrigerator on wheels, and it doesn't fit my self-image. I see myself more as a Lexus SC430. My budget sees me as a second-hand Honda Civic. My bank was willing to stretch to a Ford Escape.
"That was Joe," I told everyone. "I have to meet him at the police station. They think they might have the guy who set fire to my car."
"Will you be back for the chicken?" my mother wanted to know. "And what about dessert?"
"Don't wait dinner. I'll get back if I can, and if not, I'll take leftovers."
I turned to Grandma. "I'm going to have to commandeer the Buick until I can replace the Escape."
"Help yourself," Grandma said, "and I'll ride with you to the police station. I could use to get out of the house, and on the way home we could stop at Steva's to see if they got the lid up for the evening viewing. I'd hate to miss out on seeing Lorraine."
20 minutes later, Grandma and I cruised into the public parking lot across the street from the cop shop. The Trenton police are housed in a no-nonsense chunk of brick and mortar in a no-nonsense part of town that gives the cops easy access to crime. The building is half cop shop and half courthouse. The courthouse half has a guard and a metal detector. The cop half has an elevator decorated with bullet holes. I looked at Grandma's big black patent leather purse. Grandma was known to, from time to time, carry a .45 long barrel.
"You don't have a gun in there, do you?" I asked. "Who, me?"
"If they catch you taking a concealed weapon into the building, they'll lock you up and throw the key away."
"How would they know I got a concealed weapon if it's concealed? They better not search me. I'm an old lady. I got certain rights."
"Carrying a concealed weapon isn't one of them." Grandma pulled the gun out of her purse and shoved it under her seat.
"I don't know what this country's coming to when an old lady can't keep a gun in her purse. We got a rule for everything these days. What about the Bill of Health? It says I can bear arms."
"That's the Bill of Rights, and I don't think it specifically addresses guns in purses." I locked the Buick and called Joe on my cell. "I'm across the street," I told him, "and I've got Grandma with me.
She isn't armed, is she?
Not anymore. I could feel Joe smile across the phone line.
I'll meet you downstairs.
Civilian traffic in the building was minimal at this time of day. The courts were closed, and police business was shifting from front-door inquiries to back-door arrests. A lone cop sat in a bulletproof cage at the end of the hall, struggling to stay awake on his shift. Morelli stepped out of the elevator just as Grandma and I swung through the front entrance doors. Grandma looked at Morelli and gave a snort.
"He's wearing a gun," she said.
"He's a cop."
"Maybe I should be a cop," Grandma said. "Do you think I'm too short?"
30 minutes later, Grandma and I were back in the Buick.
"That didn't take long," Grandma said. "I hardly had a chance to look around."
"I couldn't make an ID. They picked up a guy who was carrying the backpack, but it wasn't the guy who ran out of the store. He said he found the backpack discarded in an alley."
"Bummer. This doesn't mean we're going to have to go back to the house, does it? I can't take any more of the galloping and the baby talk."
"Valerie talks baby talk to the baby?"
"No, she talks it to Clown. I don't like to make judgments on people, but after a couple hours of listening to Honey Pie Smoochy Bear Cuddle Umpkins, I'm ready to smack someone."
Okay, so I was glad I'd never been there when Valerie called Clown Cuddle Umpkins, because I would have wanted to smack someone too, and my self-restraint isn't as well honed as Grandma's. "It's too early to go to the viewing," I said to Grandma. "I guess I could stop in on Sally Sweet. He turned up failure to appear today on an assault charge."
"No kidding. I remember him. He was a nice young man. Sometimes he was a nice young woman. He had a plaid skirt I always admired."
I pulled out of the lot, right turned onto North Clinton, and followed the road for almost a quarter mile. At one time in Trenton's history, this was a thriving industrial area. The industry had all vacated or drastically downsized, and the rotting carcasses of factories and warehouses produced an ambience similar to what you might find in post-war Bosnia. I left Clinton and wove my way through a neighborhood of small, bleak, single-story row houses. Originally designed to contain the factory workers, the row houses were now occupied by hard-working people who lived one step above welfare. Plus, there were a few oddballs like Sally Sweet. I found Fenton and parked in front of Sweet's house. "Wait in the car until I find out what's going on," I said to Grandma.
"Sure,"
Grandma said, her hands gripping her purse in excited anticipation, her eyes glued to Sweet's front door. The Buick was a car designed for a man, and Grandma seemed swallowed up by the monster. Her feet barely touched the floor. Her face was barely visible over the dash. A timid woman might feel overwhelmed by Big Blue. Grandma was a little shrunken, but she wasn't timid, and there wasn't a whole lot that overwhelmed Grandma. 30 seconds after Grandma agreed to wait in the car, she was on the sidewalk, following me to Sweet's front door.
"I thought you were going to wait in the car," I said. "I changed my mind. I thought you might need help."
"Okay, but let me do the talking. I don't want to alarm him."
"Sure,"
Grandma said. I knocked on Sweet's front door, and the door opened on the third knock. Sally Sweet looked out at me, recognition kicked in, and his face creased into a grin.
"Long time no see," he said. "What brings you to my casa?"
"We're here to drag your behind back to jail," Grandma said.
"Fuck,"
Sally said, and he slammed the door shut.
"What was that?"
I asked Grandma.
"I don't know. It just popped out."
I gave another rap on the door.
"Open the door," I said. "I just want to talk to you."
Sally cracked the door and peeked at me.
"I can't go to jail. I'll lose my job."
"Maybe I can help." The door opened wide. Sally stepped to the side to allow us entry, and I gave Grandma a warning glare.
"My mouth is zipped," she said, making a zipping gesture. "And look, I'm locking the zipper and throwing away the key. See me throw away the key?"
Sally and I stared at Grandma.
"Oomph, oomph, oomph,"
Grandma said. "So, what's new?" I asked Sally.
"I get band gigs on weekends," he said. "Weekdays, I drive a school bus. It's not like the glory days when I was with the Lovelies, but it's pretty cool."
"What's with the assault charge?"
It's bogus, man. I was having a discussion with this dude, and all of a sudden he started coming on to me, and I was, hey, man, that's not where I live, you know. I mean, okay, so I was wearing a dress, but that's my professional persona. Wearing a dress is my thing. It's my trademark now. Sure, I was playing support for a rap group, but people still expect me to be in a pretty dress. I'm Sally Sweet, you know. I got a reputation.
I could see where it might be confusing, Grandma said.
I was trying hard not to look appalled. So, you hit him?
Only once, with my guitar, knocked him on his keister.
Holy cow, I said. Was he hurt bad?
No, but I broke his glasses. The guy was such a pussy. He started it all, and then he reported it to the police. He said I hit him for no reason, called me a drugged-out guitar player.
Were you drugged out?
No way. Sure, I smoke weed between sets, but everybody knows weed doesn't count as drugs if you're a guitar player, and I'm real careful. I buy organic. I only do natural drugs, you know. It's okay if they're natural. Natural weed, natural shrooms.
I didn't know that, Grandma said.
It's a fact, Sally told her. I think it might even be union rules that guitar players have to do weed between sets.
That makes sense, Grandma said. Yeah, I said. That would explain a lot.
Sally was out of costume, wearing jeans and ratty sneakers and a faded Black Sabbath t-shirt. He was over 6 feet tall in flats and close to 7 in heels. He had a large hook nose, and he had a lot of black hair everywhere. He was an okay guy, but he was without a shadow of a doubt the ugliest drag queen in the tri-state area. I couldn't imagine any man in his right mind coming on to Sally. Why didn't you show up for your court date? I asked Sally.
I had to drive the little dudes. It was a school day. I take this job very seriously.
And you forgot?
Yeah, he said. I fucking forgot.
He closed his eyes and smacked his head with the heel of his hand.
Darn.
He was wearing a thick elastic band around his left wrist. He snapped the elastic against his wrist and yelped.
Ow!
Grandma and I both did raised eyebrows.
I'm trying to quit cussing, Sally said. The little dudes were getting detention for talking trash mouth after getting off my bus. So my boss gave me this elastic band, and I have to snap it every time I cuss.
I looked down at his wrist. It was solid red welts. Maybe you should think about getting a different job.
No fucking way. Oh, shit. Damn. Snap, snap, snap.
That's gotta hurt, Grandma said.
Yeah, it hurts like a bitch,
Sally said. Snap. If I brought Sally in now, he'd have to overnight and wait for the courts to open before Vinny could bond him out again. He didn't look like much of a threat to flee, so I decided to give him a break and bring him in during business hours. I have to get you rebonded, I said to Sally. We can arrange a time between bus runs.
Wow, that would be awesome. I always have a couple hours off in the middle of the day.
Grandma looked at her watch.
We better get a move on if we want to get to the funeral home on time.
Hey, rock on, Sally said. Who's laid out?
Lorraine Schnagel. I went earlier today, but they had the lid down on the casket.
Sally made a sympathetic sound.
Don't you hate that?
Drives me nuts, Grandma said. So I'm going back, hoping the lid will be up for the night viewing.
Sally had his hands in his pockets, and he was nodding his head like a bobblehead doll.
I hear you. Give my best to Lorraine.
Grandma's face lit.
Maybe you want to come with us. Even with the lid down, it should be a good viewing. Lorraine was real popular. The place will be packed, and Steve always puts out cookies.
I could do that, Sally said, still bobbing. Just give me a second to get more dressed up.
Sally disappeared into the bedroom, and I made a deal with God that I'd try to be a nicer person if only Sally didn't return in slingback heels and a gown. When Sally reappeared, he was still wearing the faded t-shirt, jeans, and ratty sneakers, but he'd added dangly rhinestone earrings and a vintage tuxedo jacket. I felt like God hadn't totally come through for me, but I was willing to take a shot at honoring the deal anyway. We all piled into the Buick and headed across town to Steva's.
I'm hungry, Grandma said. I wouldn't mind having a burger. We haven't got a lot of time, though, so maybe we could do a drive-by.
A quarter mile later, I swung into the drive-through lane of a McDonald's and ordered a bag of food. A Big Mac, fries, and a chocolate shake for Grandma. Cheeseburger and Coke for me. A chicken Caesar salad and Diet Coke for Sally.
I have to watch my weight, Sally said. I have this to die for red gown, and I'd be pissed if I fucking grew out of it.
He grimaced.
Oh, shit.
Snap, snap, snap.
Maybe you should try not to talk, Grandma said. You're going to give yourself a blood clot with all that snapping.
I handed the bag of food over to Grandma for distribution and pulled forward. A guy dressed out in a black do-rag, homeboy jeans, new basketball shoes, and a lot of gold jewelry that flashed in the overhead streetlight exited the McDonald's and headed for a car with a high bling rating. It was a brand new black Lincoln Navigator with gleaming chrome wheel covers and black tinted windows. I rolled closer to get a better look and confirmed my suspicion. It was Red Devil. He was carrying a huge bag of food plus a drink holder with four cups. Now, I know the Red Devil's held up 14 deli marts, and I personally saw him toss a flaming Molotov cocktail into a store. So on the one hand, I had to think that this was a bad guy. Problem was, it was hard to take someone seriously when he was going around doing his robbing wearing a cheap rubber mask, riding on a mountain bike.
Hey, I shouted at him, wait a minute, I want to talk to you.
When I got close enough to talk, I was going to reach out and choke him until he turned blue. I didn't care all that much about his deli mart robbing career, but I was really unhappy about my yellow escape. He stopped and stared at me and suddenly placed me.
You, he said. You're one of the dumb bitches who trashed my bike.
You're calling me dumb? I yelled back at him. You're the one going around robbing stores dressed up in a stupid mask, riding a kid's bike. I bet you're too dumb to get a driver's license.
Dumb bitch, he said again. Dumb punk-ass bitch.
The passenger side door opened on the Navigator, and I could hear guys laughing inside the car. Red Devil got in, slammed the door shut, and the car came to life. I was itching to jump out of the Buick, run over to the SUV, wrench the door open, and drag the devil guy out of the car. Since by my cup tally, there most likely were at least three other people in the Lincoln, and they might all have guns, and they might be cranky about me ruining their dinner, I decided to go with the more conservative plan of getting the license plate number and following at a respectful distance.
Was that the devil bandit?
Grandma wanted to know. Yes. Grandma sucked in some air.
Let's get him, ram him from behind, and then when he stops, we'll drag him out of the car.
I can't do that. I have no authority to capture him.
Okay, so we don't capture him. How about we just kick him a couple times after we get him out of the car?
That would be assault, Sally said, and it turns out it's illegal.
I hit the speed dial for Morelli's number on my cell phone.
Is this about the Japanese triplets?
Morelli wanted to know. No, it's about Red Devil. I'm in the Buick with Grandma and Sally Sweet, and I'm following the devil guy. We're on state heading south. I just passed Olden. He's in a new black Lincoln Navigator.
I'll put it out. Don't approach him.
No problemo.
I gave Morelli the license number and put my phone on the seat next to my leg. I followed the SUV for three blocks and saw a blue and white come up behind me. I pulled to the side, the blue and white sped past and put his lights on. Grandma and Sally were mouths open, eyes glued to the cop car in front of me.
That guy in the SUV isn't stopping, Grandma said.
The SUV ran a light, and we all followed. I knew the cop in front of me. It was Eddie Gazzara, riding alone. He was a likable, blonde-haired Polish chunk, and he was married to my cousin, Shirley the Whiner. He was probably looking in his rearview mirror, wishing I'd go away. The SUV suddenly made a right turn and then a quick left. Eddie stuck to his bumper, and I struggled to stay with Eddie, using my whole body to help muscle the Buick around corners. I was sweating from the exertion. Probably some of the sweat was from fear. I was at the brink of losing control of the car, and I was worried about Gazzara all by himself in front of me. My cell was still on, still connected to Morelli.
We're chasing these guys,
I yelled down at the phone, giving Morelli cross streets, telling him Gazzara was in front of me.
We? Morelli yelled back. There's no we. This is a police chase. Go home.
Sally had himself braced in the back seat, his rhinestone earrings reflecting in my rearview mirror.
He could be right, you know. Maybe we should split.
Don't listen to him, Grandma said, her blue-veined, bony hands gripping the shoulder strap. Keep the pedal to the metal. You could be a little careful on the turns, though, she added. I'm an old lady. My neck could snap like a twig if you whip around a corner too fast.
Not much chance of taking a corner that fast in the Buick. Motoring the Buick around was like steering a cruise ship. Without warning, the SUV went into a turn in the middle of the road and skidded to a stop. Eddie laid some rubber and pulled up a couple car lengths from the SUV. I two-footed the brake pedal and stopped about a foot from Eddie's back bumper. The rear side window slid down on the SUV, and there was a flash of rapid gunfire from inside the car. Grandma and Sally hit the floor, but I was too stunned to move. The blue and white's windshield crumbled, and I saw Eddie jerk to the side and slump. I think Eddie's shot, I yelled at my phone.
Fuck, Sally said from the back seat.
Snap. The SUV took off, wheels spinning, and was out of sight within seconds. I shoved my door open and ran to check on Gazzara. He was hit twice. A bullet had grazed the side of his head, and he had a shoulder wound.
Shit, I said to Gazzara. Don't die.
Gazzara looked at me through narrowed eyes.
Do I look like I'm gonna die?
No, but I'm not an expert.
Cripes, what happened? It was like World War III broke out.
Seemed like the gentleman in the SUV didn't want to chat with you.
I was being glib, hoping it would keep me from bursting into tears. I'd stripped my t-shirt off and had it pressed to Gazzara's shoulder wound. Thank goodness I was wearing a sports bra, because I'd feel conspicuous if I was wearing my lacy Victoria's Secret Wonder bra when the cops got here. There was undoubtedly a first aid kit in the squad car, but I wasn't thinking that clearly. The t-shirt seemed easier and faster. I was pressing hard enough that my hands weren't visibly shaking, but my heart was racing and my breathing was ragged. Grandma and Sally were standing huddled together in silence by the Buick.
Is there anything we can do?
Grandma asked.
Talk to Joe. He's on the cell phone. Tell him Gazzara needs help.
Sirens were screaming in the distance, and I could see the flash of police strobes a block away.
Shirley's gonna be pissed, Gazzara said. She hates when I get shot.
To my recollection, the only other time Gazzara was shot was when he was playing quick draw in the police station elevator and his gun accidentally discharged. The bullet ricocheted off the elevator wall and lodged in Gazzara's right buttock. The first cop car angled in. It was followed by a second blue and white and Morelli in his SUV. I took a step back to allow the man access to Eddie. Morelli looked first to me and then glanced over at Gazzara.
Are you okay?
He asked. I was covered with blood, but it wasn't mine.
I didn't get hit. Eddie's been shot twice, but I think he's going to be all right.
I guess there are places in this country where cops are always perfectly pressed. Trenton wasn't one of those places. Trenton cops worked hard and worried a lot. Every cop on the scene had a sweat-soaked shirt and grim set to his mouth, including Morelli.
They opened fire with an automatic weapon from the back seat, I told Morelli. We were coming out of the McDonald's drive-thru on State, and I saw the devil guy cross the lot and get into the Lincoln. The devil guy got into the front passenger seat, so he wasn't the shooter. He had four drinks with him, so there were probably three other guys in the car. I followed him out of the lot and called you. You know the rest.
Morelli slid an arm around me and pulled me close, resting his cheek on mine.
I don't want to get mushy here in front of the guys, but there was a moment back there when I heard shots fired over the phone, and I didn't care a lot about the triplets.
Nice to know, I said, slumping against him, happy to have someone holding me up.
It happened so fast. No one got out of a car. Eddie was still buckled into his seatbelt. They shot him through the windshield.
The Lincoln was stolen. They probably thought Gazzara was going to bust them.
No, it was me, I said. This is all my fault. The Red Devil knew I recognized him.
An EMT truck arrived and parked next to Gazzara. Cops were directing traffic, securing the area, shouting over the static and chatter of the dispatch radio.
It's uncanny the way you stumble into this stuff, Morelli said. It's creepy.
Grandma was standing behind us.
Two disasters in one day, she said. I bet it's a personal record.
Not even close, Morelli said.
His eyes settled on my sports bra.
I like the new look.
I use my t-shirt as a compress.
Morelli removed his shirt and draped it around my shoulders.
You feel cold.
That's because my heart stopped pumping blood about 10 minutes ago. My skin was pale and clammy, and my forearms were goosebumpy. I need to get back to my parents' house and have some dessert.
I could use some dessert, too, Grandma said. Probably they don't have the lid up on Lorraine anyway.
She turned to Sally.
I know I promised you a good time at the funeral parlor, but it didn't work out. How about some dessert instead? We got chocolate cake and ice cream, and then we can send you home in a cab. My son-in-law drives a cab sometimes, so we get a break on the rates.
I guess I could eat some cake, Sally said. I probably burned off a couple hundred calories just now from fright.
Morelli buttoned me into his shirt.
Are you going to be okay to drive?
Yeah, I don't even feel like throwing up anymore.
I need to check on a few things here, and then I'll follow you over.
My mother was on the front porch when we arrived. She was rigid, with her arms crossed over her chest and her lips pressed tight together.
She knows, Grandma said. I bet the phone's been ringing off the hook.
How could she know?
Sally asked.
We were way across town, and it's been less than an hour, start to finish.
The first call always comes from Tracy Wenke and Myron Flatt on account of they listen to the police band on their radios, Grandma said. And then Elsa Downing probably called. She finds out early because her daughter works as a dispatcher. And I bet Shirley called to see if she could drop the kids off so she could go to the hospital.
I parked the Buick, and by the time I got to my mother, her face was white, and I expected steam to begin curling out of her ears at any moment.
Don't start, I said. I'm not talking about it until I've had some cake.
My mother wheeled around without a word, marched to the kitchen, and sliced me a wedge of cake. I followed after her.
Ice cream, I said.
She scooped half a tub of ice cream onto my plate. She stepped back and looked at me.
Blood,
she said.
Not mine.
She made the sign of the cross. And I'm pretty sure Eddie's going to be okay. Another cross. There'd been places left at the table for Grandma and me. I took my place and shoveled in cake. Grandma brought an extra chair from the kitchen for Sally and bustled around filling plates. The rest of the family was silent at the dining room table. Only my father was active, head down, forking up chicken and mashed potatoes. Everyone else was frozen in their seats, mouths open, eyes wide, not sure what to make of me with the blood on my shirt, and Sally in his earrings.
You all remember Sally, don't you? Grandma asked his introduction. He's a famous musician, and he's a girl sometimes. He's got a whole bunch of pretty dresses and high-heel shoes and makeup. He's even got one of them black leather bustier things with pointy ice cream cone breasts. You don't even hardly notice his chest hair when he's got that bustier thing on.
Chapter 3.
How can he be a girl sometimes?
Mary Alice wanted to know. Mary Alice is in second grade and is 2 years younger than her sister, Angie. Mary Alice can ride a bike, play Monopoly if someone helps her read the chance cards, and can recite the names of all of Santa's reindeer. She's in the dark on gender crossing.
I just dress up like a girl, Sally said. It's part of my onstage persona.
I'd want to dress up like a horse, Mary Alice said.
Angie looked at Sally's wrist.
Why are you wearing an elastic band?
I'm trying to quit cussing, Sally said. Every time I cuss, I snap the elastic band. It's supposed to make me not want to cuss anymore.
You should just say a different word than the cuss word, Angie said. Something that sounds like the cuss word.
I've got it, Grandma said. Fudge, that's what you should say.
Fudge, Sally repeated. I don't know. I feel silly saying fudge.
What's the red stuff all over Aunt Stephanie?
Mary Alice wanted to know.
Blood, Grandma said. We were in a shootout. None of us got hurt, but Stephanie was helping out Eddie Gazzara. He was shot twice, and he had blood spurting all over the place.
Ew,
Angie said. Valerie's live-in boyfriend, Albert Clown, was seated next to me. He looked down at my blood-spattered arm and fainted. Crash, right off his chair.
He fucking fainted, Sally said. Oh, fudge.
Snap. I was done with my cake, so I went to the kitchen and tried to clean up. Probably I should have cleaned up before coming to the table, but I really needed the cake. When I got back to the table, Albert was sitting in his seat.
I'm not squeamish or anything, he said. I just slipped. It was one of those freak accidents.
Albert Clown was about 5'7", had sandy blonde hair showing the beginnings of male pattern baldness, and the chubby face and body of a 12-year-old. He was a lawyer, of sorts, and he was the father of Valerie's baby. He was a sweet guy, but he felt more like a pet than a future brother-in-law. His office was located next to a laundromat, and he dispensed more quarters than legal advice. There was a light rap on the front door. The door opened, and Joe walked in. My mother was immediately running for an extra plate, not sure where she was going to put it. Even with the leaf in, the table could only accommodate 8, and Joe made 10.
Here,
Clown said, jumping to his feet.
You can have my place. I'm done eating. I don't mind. Honest.
Isn't he a cuddle umpkins? Valerie said.
Grandma hid behind her napkin and made a gagging gesture. Morelli held his response to a benign smile. My father kept eating, and it occurred to me that cuddle-umpkins fit Clown perfectly. How awful is that?
Now that everyone's here, I have an announcement to make, Valerie said. Albert and I have set a date to get married.
This was an important announcement, because when Valerie was pregnant, she was thinking she might hold out for Ranger or Indiana Jones. This was a worrisome situation, since it was unlikely either of those guys would be interested in marrying Valerie. Valerie's opinion of Albert Clown improved with the birth of the baby, but until this moment, my mother harbored the fear that she'd be saddled with Valerie gossip for the rest of her life. Unwed mothers, horrific painful deaths, and cheating husbands were the favorite topics of the Berg gossip mongers.
That's wonderful,
my mother said, clapping a hand to her mouth, her eyes filling with tears.
I'm so happy for you.
A wedding, Grandma said. I'll need a new dress, and we need a hall for the reception.
She dabbed at her eyes.
Look at me. I'm all teary.
Valerie was crying, too. She was laughing and sniffling back sobs.
I'm gonna marry my snuggie Wuggums, she said.
Morelli paused, his fork halfway to the roast chicken platter. He slid his eyes to me and leaned close.
If you ever call me Snuggy Wuggums in public, I'll lock you in the cellar and chain you to the furnace.
Clown was standing at the end of the table with a glass of wine in his hand.
I have to make a toast, he said, to the future Mrs. Clown.
My mother went still as stone. She hadn't totally thought through the consequences of Valerie's marriage to Albert.
Valerie Clown,
she said, trying not to show her horror.
Holy crap,
my father said. I leaned close to Morelli.
Now I'm not the only clown in the family, I whispered.
Morelli raised his glass.
To Valerie Clown, he said.
Clown drained his glass and refilled it.
And to me, because I'm the luckiest man ever. I found my lovey pumpkin, my one true lovey-dovey, my big fat sweetie pie.
Hey, wait a minute, Valerie said. Big, fat, sweetie pie?
Grandma refilled her wine glass.
Somebody stun gun him, she said. I can't take no more.
Clown rushed on. His face was flushed, and he'd started to sweat.
I've even got a baby, he said. Well, I don't know how that happened. Well, I mean, I guess I know how it happened. I think it happened on the couch in there.
Everyone but Joe sucked in some air. Joe was smiling.
And to think I almost missed this, he whispered to me.
My mother looked like tomorrow she'd be shopping for a new couch, and my father was studying his butter knife, undoubtedly wondering how much damage he could do. Good thing the carving knife was in the kitchen.
It usually takes clowns years to get pregnant, Albert said. Historically, we have a low mobility. Our guys can't swim. That's what my father always said. He said, Albert, don't expect to be a father because clowns can't swim. And look at this. My guys could swim. It's not like I was even trying. I just couldn't figure out how to get the thingy on. And then once I got it on, but I think it had a hole in it because it seemed like it was leaking. Wouldn't it be something if that was the time? Wouldn't it be something if my guys could swim through the thingy? Like I had Superman guys.
Poor Snuggy Uggams was motoring down the road to doom, gaining momentum, out of control, with no idea how to stop.
"Do something,"
I said to Joe.
"He's dying."
Morelli was still wearing his gun. He took it off his hip and pointed it at Clown.
"Albert,"
he said very calmly,
"shut up."
"Thank you,"
Clown said, and then he wiped the sweat off his forehead with his shirt tail.
"What about dessert?" my father wanted to know. "Isn't anyone going to serve dessert?"
It was close to 9 when Morelli and I staggered through the front door to his townhouse. Bob the dog came galloping from the kitchen to greet us, attempted a sliding